Fish number 12241, Mr. William Laverick, reel 15.
Mr. Laverick, reel 15. We're talking about these pamphlets that came out and how you'd been trained in them, you'd learned them, and then you had to present them to your own unit. How did the men and women of your unit react?
Reacted very, very favourably, because you see, APCA, the Army Bureau of Current Affairs, they had got into the position where they had people coming to units, and once they arrived at a unit, an hour of time had to be provided for them to give their discussions. This was before the pamphlets actually came out on British Way and Purpose. So, of course, that had prepared the way. When we came back from the courses on the British Way and Purpose, we immediately took over this time period that these people had that were travelling sites. So we were able to arrange for the discussions, and we had all the various subjects, start with the one pamphlet, tell them what the pamphlet was about, ask for any ideas, and then start to lead the discussion from then.
Was it an all-ranks discussion or just...
All-ranks... discussion.
Officers as well?
Officers as well.
What about... although it was a national government, as you've explained, there were, to your mind, socialist pamphlets. Wouldn't that cause conservatives amongst perhaps the officers or senior NCOs, perhaps, to react against them?
It didn't then. The point was that, you see, we're on the latter end of the war, and it was one of these peculiar things that even the rank difference had sort of disappeared by the end of the war. You conversed with anyone, officers or anyone, you were just conversing with. You just, when you were on duty, that you...
But what, I meant actual conservatives, you know.
Yes. Well, off duty, you see, it made no difference. You had your arguments with them, and such, like, on various things.
What did they oppose them on? I mean, there was opposition then to them.
There was opposition to there was no opposition in my unit to the pamphlets, but there was opposition from certain quarters outside of the units. There's where the opposition came from. The politicians were the ones, certain not politicians. The Beveridge Report was objected to by certain political parties. But on the sites themselves, it was discussed and gone through bit by bit, the Beveridge Report. And you got a terrific amount of people. There were many more in favour than what there were against the Beveridge Report. And of course it was a big thing, because you see, it was from the cradle to the grave was the Beveridge. It started from birth and finished at pension age, finished at death. You were going to get death benefits and everything, burial, you were going to get the mother was going to be paid for the birth, and then the one left behind was going to be paid for the death, right through from start to. And this was actually in the Beveridge Report when you were taking it through, and it was a very good pamphlet.
Did you have any contacts? I mean, you'd been out, Hayes Common, wasn't it? South London, anyway. You'd been out there a long time. Did you have any contacts with the local Labour Party in that area?
We never touched on any of the political parties in the area. I was interested in sport, and wherever I went and joined the local Harrier Club. I joined Cambridge Harriers, actually, when I was down in that area, down in the London area. It's called Cambridge Harriers. I don't know why, because it's not in Cambridge. It's in South London. And I was termed a service member of the Cambridge Harriers, which was another... it was hard to describe. You went along in training, and you trained with them, with your gym shoes. You had plimsolls when you were in the service, as well as your boots, you see. And you trained in plimsolls. But when it came to racing, We had to accept service regulations, which meant you run in boots. I was fortunate. I had a pair of special boots, light boots, that I had made when the foot was injured. I didn't suffer too much. But we, in the walks and such like, we had race walks and whatnot with the various clubs. I could wear these light boots, which would have...
But I mean, as a socialist, didn't you yourself privately come in contact with the Labour Party?
The discussions outside of the Army, we had discussions, but I don't know, in sport, discussions on politics and such like, you have your differences of opinion.
But I mean, in general life, didn't you come
No, out? No, we in general life, not at all. even when it was coming on to the 1945 elections, there didn't seem to be any, you know, it didn't rouse the election fever that you get in some elections.
How did you feel? So you were doing, how much time a week would you be spending on ABCA stuff?
I'd be spending, in a week, I'd be spending an hour a day, say, on ABCA.
And the rest would be your normal duties?
And the rest were normal duties.
Running the site?
Running the site, yes.
Did you ever want to get overseas and get into the war?
Oh, yes. The units I have been with, you say that I have been put into, I was seconded to quite a few different units. And when they were going overseas, I was taken out again and sent back to the training establishment as an instructor. And the peculiar thing was
that... Was it at the end of the war?
At the end of the war...
You stayed with 443.
I stayed with
443. You're meaning beforehand, yeah.
That's right. Beforehand, I'd been with various units. Units that were actually being prepared for overseas. And yet, one time I actually reached over. You see, I mentioned that I reached over and was sent back to the camp as an instructor.
Were you disappointed?
Very disappointed at the time, because they were all pals that were going over. Very disappointed.
So what happened as the war went on, that after D-Day and into 44 and into 45, did anything in particular happen, or was it just routine?
It was very routine. It was very routine then. And then, of course, you see, we had VE. We had VE Day came along, and acceleration. All camps were immediately, sentries were brought in and such like, they were no longer needed. And everyone was sort of shaking hands, having a drink. And I remember I got permission to use the phone and phoned to my wife's battery, and she left her battery and came across to his and met me there. And we decided that, seeing everyone felt the same, we'd go down to London and see what things were like down there. And we went down to Oxford Street and Trafalgar Square, and we couldn't move. Just couldn't move. And it was all sorts. There were seamen, there were Americans, there were the Polish troops, the French troops. You see, we had big contingents of other overseas troops being trained in this country, ready for it. And there were a lot of them. They were all there. And hanging on the lamppost, they were in Trafalgar Square, they were on there. It was so... We couldn't get a drink anywhere. We couldn't get into a pub for a drink or anything. So we decided we'd go back to Hayes Common. And I said, on the way back to Hayes Common, I said, there's a pub down just from the site. We'll call in there and have a drink there. Couldn't even get in the pub. Crowds wherever you went. So we went back to the site and actually celebrated on the site. We celebrated on the site at Hayes Common. And from then on, the only thing you were looking forward to then was your demobilisation. You were thinking about what you were going to do when you were demobilised. And you see, this is when these pamphlets had come in handy, because one of the pamphlets actually told you the type of austerity and such like that you're going to have to go through. And one of the pamphlets actually mentioned the poverty time that we're going to reach because of the lease lending, such like the cost of lease land. We hadn't realised. And quite frankly, when I realised and I read the lease land agreements and such like that we'd made with the Americans, and what it had cost us, and how it had set us back years and years. The GL that I told you about earlier, it must have been one of the greatest inventions that there was in the time it was handed over to the Americans, because of the lease land agreement that had to hand it over for development by the Americans and such like. We lost all that. We lost all this development. And I was anti-American. I was actually anti-American. After I read the terms and whatnot, I thought, well, that's not friendly. They're actual enemies. They've put us in pawn.
Had you come into much contact with American troops? Because they were over here, weren't they?
I avoided the Americans as much as I possibly could, because we actually followed them twice into camp. And we had a dreadful job of clearing up the camp after them. They weren't disciplined the same as we were in camp discipline. The camps were wild. Well, we went wherever we went. We made gardens and such like. We made a camp a camp. We made it a home the time we were there. We actually used to paint, the white paint, the stones that they had down the paths and whatnot. And at one site, we actually white painted the coal. We had a tremendous heap of coal, and we painted the sides of the coal, whatever for, I don't know, but we did. We got the instruction to paint the coal, and we whitewashed the coal.
Is that really, you really did that? It's not just an old story?
That's not an army story. That was actually done. It was whitewashed because it looked better as you went into the camp. You see, the coal stuck. Mine was good coal. I don't know where they got it from, but this was an actual fact. And everything was whitewashed, and this is what tickled us in wartime. Your whitewash brushes, the stones and things in the camp were all whitewashed. They weren't camouflaged, and yet if you went in do any battle training, you put camouflage on, and yet you walked into a camp and it was painted. So you could see the reason for it. And that may have been the reason for the coal being painted also, because you see, had to be taken away when it was wanted. It might have been taken away in the dark, and of course, naturally, if they followed the white stones, because there were you weren't allowed headlights or anything, and you weren't allowed to put lights on, so it could be possible that it was done for that purpose. You see, they knew where the stack was because it was white. It could have been for that purpose.
You could see if people had taken any as well, I suppose.
You could see what?
If people had taken any.
Oh, you could see if people had... That's right. That could be another reason. Actually, we were in a camp one time, and the roads had been made up with... it looked to me like waste from Colliery Heap. And we suddenly realised that this waste, you only had to pull it out and put it on your stove, break it up and put it on the stoves, and it burnt like mad once the stove was alight. So at night time, we should just nip out, pull up a lump of the road, straight in again, smash it up with a hammer and put it on the stove. Your stoves went all night in the services, you know. In the winter, they were going all night.
So after VE Day, I mean, what happened for you then? What happened next?
Well, the thing was that we had to go back to off-wartime training. We went under peacetime training. You went back to your foot slogging and your inspections, your full inspections and such like at certain times. Things eased, but you still had more inspections and more... everything, your guns and things were come around and they checked them. And actually, we started repainting all the guns and whatnot, and every nipple on the gun had to have a different colour, depending on the type of oil that you had to put in. The guns had different types of oil for different methods, and we had to paint the nipples all different colours, some red, some yellows, some greens. And this was done after war was finished. You see, your guns weren't going to be used again, so I suppose before they returned them back to wherever they had to go, they were going to return back in new condition. And actually, we changed the barrel of a gun at Hayes after the war. We changed one of the barrels of the gun at Hayes after the war. I remember the mech coming around and saying that they wanted the barrel changed. And the war was finished then. We still changed the barrel of the gun. But things were very, very much easier then. And
were you demobilised before the election?
I was fortunate, yes. I was one of the early.
When were you demobbed then?
When would it be? I was demobbed before my missus. The war finished in the...
May 45.
That's right, May.
And then August, the Japanese War.
That's right, the Japanese War finished then. And I think I was in the third lot of people that were demobbed, the third demob. And peculiar, I cannot even remember I remember going for my suit and getting it. And mind, I got a grand suit. I had it for years and years and years. A real good fit it was. But I came out early. I was one of the early demob. And I was very, very pleased because I knew, one of the pamphlets had told us that there were going to be approximately 4 million for demobilisation over a period of time and had to find work. And we knew straight away then that work was going to be something that we're going to be chased after. So we wanted to get out quickly to get things sorted out before the next lot.
Now, what rank had you finished up as?
Finished up as a sergeant. I was acting sergeant major, but I finished up with a war sergeant rank.
So what did you do when you were demobilised?
We had no house. I was married, you see. My wife had got out. My wife got out just about the same time as me. When I said I was going to be demobilised, she also got her demobilisation. There wasn't the need for the women to go through the same numbers as what we were. You know, they could nearly all come out in one lot where we were being sent out in various groups. But we were demobilised and we went to live with her mother for a time. We didn't have a house, you see. We'd been married during the war, just the start of the war. We didn't have a house. And then, of course, 2 or 3 months later, she turned around and told me she was pregnant. And I said, right, this is it. We're going to get cracking and find a house. So I said, we've got to find a job with a house. And I had been doing odd little jobs. You see, we were paid up to a certain time in the services. We paid up and we had this cash. And then I had been to a compensation board because of my B7 and the AB64. When I showed them the B7 and the A, and they saw that I was you handed in the AB64s and they checked over and they told me that I had to go to such and such a tribunal in Newcastle and Grey Street because of the low grading that I was being sent out in. So I went to the in front of the tribunal and they examined the foot and told me that yes, there was a they imagined that there was a below a 20% difference and it was there to be seen. You could see the foot was completely knacked. It was, and they gave me a pension. I got 8 and 9 pence for 1 year, 9 and 9 pence the next year. Eight and sixpence 1 year, 9 and 6 pence for the second year, and then the £40 payment to finalise. And that was for the injury to the...
A week, you foot. Mean?
That was, yes, a week. 8 and 6 a week. And I had, of course, I had this coming in. I had my army pay. And I had, it was a sergeant's pay, you see. And the time, I don't know how long it was, but you were paid up for a certain time. You still weren't left the service. Even though you were demobbed, your army pay carried on for a certain time, you see. And during... Very, very fortunate, I came down to mother's place. We were at Amble, at Bess's place. And I came down to Gosforth. And my brother-in-law sent me here. I said to him that I was looking for a job at a house. He says, a job in the papers, last night's paper. And he went and got the paper. And there was a job there, but it was for up in Scotland, just over the Scottish border, Tweed Hill Stables. It was a great big house. I didn't know then, of course. I didn't know what it was like. But the job was there. Gardener required. A cottage with it, lodge, that was it, a lodge went with the job. So I immediately applied, and the offices were in Gosforth, which was handy for me, and I went up and saw he was some sort of engineer, bridge engineer, I think, Brackenbury, a firm called Brackenbury, actually, and applied for the job. And he asked what training I had in gardening, and I told him I was only an amateur gardener, but I was very, very keen. I'd always been very, very keen on gardening, vegetable, flowers, anything you wanted. So he gave me the job. He says, right, we'll give you the job and see what you make of it. He says, it's a walled garden. I had no idea what the place was like, what the house was like. He says, there's a walled garden. He says, and actually, he says, we have about 300 acres of ground. But there were woods and pastures, but this was all let out to the farm. And he says, there's a lodge, he says, where you live. So I immediately went out and told my wife I'd got a job. Another thing he told me was agricultural wages. Well, I had no idea at the time what agricultural wages were. I didn't realise that there was pay in the country. So I went out and phoned my wife. Well, I phoned her uncle and told him to tell Bess that I'd got a job to come down to Gosforth and would stay down there for a while until I had got things settled up. So she left Amble and came down to Gosforth, and I went down to Brackenbury again. He had told me to see him in a fortnight. I had to see them in a fortnight for some reason. But I went up and saw him in the fortnight, and he says, yes, he says, the job's yours, definitely yours. He says, you can go up any time you like. I said, well, we are wanting to be up as soon as possible. So we went up. He gave us the fares, actually. He gave us the fares for to go up. We got to Berwick, and then from Berwick we got the bus up to Tweed Hill. We got the bus to Horncliffe the first time we went up on the English side of the border and walked across the Tweed and up to Tweed Hill. And we could see the hall as we were walking up in the grounds. A terrific place, a terrific hall it was. And we walked up the road to where the lodge was that we were going to live in. Went down to the hall and got the key for the lodge. There was a housekeeper at the hall that didn't live there. Blackenberries didn't live there. They only went up weekends and holidays. This was their second home. God knows what the first one was like, the size of the second one. It was like a stately mansion. Next door to Douglas Holmes' place on the Tweed. So there were hens and such like there. They had hens and things there. So I went up, got the key, went up the lodge. When we opened the door and went into the lodge, two rooms. There was the kitchenette, just the kitchen, and there was the bedroom. No water in the place. No electric light, no water. Just the two bare rooms. So I went down and I told them, I says, oh, I says, you'll have to tell. I says, can I phone from here to Mr. Brackenbury? She says, he can phone to the office. He may be in. I phoned down and I told him straight away. I says, I'm not going in that lodge. I says, no water. He says, oh, they get the water from the house. I says, not me. I says, I'm not carrying water from the house. I says, my wife's going to have a baby and we'll need lots of water. So he says, well, he says, I'm coming up this weekend. He says, just stay where you are. He says, stay at the big house. Tell them to give you a room in the servants' quarters at the big house, at the house. He says, I'm coming up this weekend. He said, we'll make arrangements. What's going to happen then? So he came up the weekend. We went up to the lodge and I told him straight that I wasn't going to go into there. Not unless there was water laid on. And I says, we'd have to have hot water as well. He said, well, you can use the boiler for the hot water. Little did we know at the time that the boiler was cracked and we couldn't use it. But anyway, he had a sink put in the kitchenette part. He had a sink put in and got water laid on from his place across the field to the lodge. And we were living in the big house now. Now, what he'd done in the big house, when he decided we would live there in servants' quarters, he got an army stove put in for cooking on. Bess had to cook on the army stove. And we had the bedroom, and we had this, like a lounge place with the army stove in, that we had to cook on. It was pretty warm, it was satisfactory. But he came and told me that things were finished, that the water was laid on. When I went up, they found that the water, there wasn't sufficient pressure for to take it to the lodge. So what they had to do was to get the plumber out again and put a pump in. So each morning I had to get up and pump and pump and pump and pump and pump till we got sufficient water in buckets and whatnot for Bess to carry on with for the rest of the day, you see.
So that sort of takes you back into civilian life. Did you stay there long?
Stayed there. Well, we'd intended to stay there. We went up purposely because Bess was pregnant. We'd intended to stay till the youngster could be moved. We could get back into civilization. It was we were a quarter of a mile from any from the big house.
So how long did you stay?
We were actually nearly 2 mile. We stayed almost 3 years. The baby was born, and we had him christened up there, and then when he could. He was still in his pram when we brought him away, but he was just starting to walk when we brought him away.
Right. So, did you play any part in the election?
As soon as I went up there, yes, I did play a part. Actually, what I'd done, we got to know the villagers straight away, and very nice people they were up at Paxton, people in Paxton. And there was a garden boy on the estate that worked under me that lived in Paxton. We got to know the people there very, very well. And what happened was, when we went down into Paxton, they said, well, you'll be coming to the church. It was one of these peculiar areas where the vicar came round, collected for his church. Every one in the area appeared so much towards the church. And this is when we got the first shock in the area. The Brackenberries came up. And we said, he says, will you be going to the church on Sunday? We said, yes, we will be. Well, he says, well, you're not going up this Sunday, we're going away, he says. But he says, you can have the estate car. There was a small estate car with a bit of a bone shaker that they used to carry the turf. We used to carry the turf and such like in on the estate. We met the people and got to know them. And as one chap that worked on the farm, Logan, was secretary of the Farm Workers Union. He was secretary of the Farm Workers Union. And I was having a chat with him, and he says, but you could do me a favour, Bill. I said, how do you mean do you a favour? I says, I haven't been here long enough to do favours for anyone. He says, you're just the chap we're waiting for, though. He says, I've got a chance of a job as farm manager at Hutton Mains. It was a 1,000-acre farm, you see. He says, but I cannot take the job on and do the union work. He says, the way things are up here, you cannot do both. They're opposite to each other. I says, right, I said, I'll take the union job on. He says, you go to Dunn's. He says, you'll only have to go to Dunn's once a week to the meetings and then try to get them organised in the area. And this was when I really found out the advantage of negotiation. Through taking over the union job, I realised straight away that I was being done on the estate.
And how did that affect the 45 general election, which is...
Well, the 45 general election was coming along. And we had Redchester at Amble. We were on the Redchester at Amble. And actually, the chap that I thought was a wonderful man was the candidate. Beveridge, Lord Beveridge. He was the candidate at Amble. So all we done was got the paper sent up to us and voted for Beveridge, but of course he didn't get in. Beveridge was defeated in the 45
election. You actually campaign at all?
We didn't campaign because we didn't know the people up there. We were in Scotland now, you see. We're in Scotland. The union were right out in the wires. Paxton was only a little village. You had nowhere for campaigning. You see, you were out in the wires. You were lost, except that I was the farmer. I've taken the job on as a secretary of the union.
So were you surprised that the Labour Party won that election?
I was very surprised, yes. Actually, very surprised. I had never expected the Labour Party to win it. I had expected a good showing from the Labour Party because of the feeling in the camps and things when you were talking to people. And I was certain that seeing that the Conservatives had got Churchill for to lead the election for them, that they were certainly, through him, not through their policy, but through the name of Churchill, I thought that the people would stand by and make sure that Churchill was their first Prime Minister.
Had you joined the Labour Party up there, or was there a Labour Party in Paxton?
We never saw anything of politics at all there, except for the union. The union was the big thing there.
Well, had you ever thought of rejoining the Territorial Army?
Yes, we actually went along. After I came back to Gosforth. This was after we left Tweed Hill. We were up there for almost 3 years, I think. After we came back to Gosforth, we went into digs at Gosforth because we didn't have a house. But the youngster could be looked after then. And I met my friend who had come back from India, Bill Bell, a sergeant that had been in the Territorials with me. And he says, how about join the Territorials again, Bill? I says, oh, it's a good idea. We'll go up and join. So we went up to the drill hall at Gosforth, and it was a new drill hall. It wasn't West Avenue. A new drill hall at Gosforth had been built. And we went up to the new drill hall, Sergeant Major there, and we saw him. We told him that we'd been demobbed and we'd been Territorials previously and we'd like to go back into the Territorials. Oh, he says, well, he says, if you come back, he says, you'll come back as privates. He said, what were you? We said we were sergeants. Oh, he says, you'll come back as privates. He says, you'll only be privates if you come back to the Territorials. No, he says, I've got young NCOs. He says, and I wouldn't want any older ones. We saw then that there were going to be complications, that we were going to come in where youngsters were going to be given, telling us what to do, something that we'd been doing for years because they had the same sort of guns as what we'd been trained, what I'd been trained on. So we decided against. We said, oh no, if we can't get back in rank, we're not going back.
Were you wanting to rejoin again as a sort of class warrior, or were you just keen on the army by then?
Keen on the army, and
you didn't think you were going to have to use fighting skills.
Well, actually, we thought that wars were finished with after that war. We thought that wars were finished with. That was going to be the final one. But we'd enjoyed the life in the territories. We'd enjoyed the companionship.
So that was different from the 1930s when you'd wanted to learn how
That's
to fight
right.
the
different,
the establishment.
Different altogether. No, the war had changed me completely. The war had changed me completely.